Good evening, guys, and welcome to Weather Eyes, a podcast broadcast by the team here at New York Metro Weather. I'm John Hominuk, and we are going to bring in Doug Simone, and I think he's here with us. Doug, are you able to connect and hear us? Is everything working well on your end?
Yes, sir. I hear you. You hear me?
Yes, I do. Awesome. Okay, so we're all set up. We're very excited to bring everyone the third episode of Weather Eyes. The first two episodes have been a great success, and we are also happy to open up the show here a little bit and give us a good hour to discuss everything that we want to discuss and you know, obviously banter a little bit about other things going on other than just forecasting and things like that. For those of you guys who are interested in calling in, if you have a question, if there's something you want to say, or if you just want to chat with us for a little bit, we are totally open to calls. We're going to give you the number here, and we'll do it again in a couple minutes. The number to call in is 323-870-3493. That's 323-870-3493, and we would love to chat with you. If you do call in and we don't get you on air right away, just hang on for a minute or two, and we'll give you a little segue to get you in there. So, Doug, thanks for joining us again, and let's get right to it. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on right now with the weather pattern across the United States and where we are in terms of what's going to happen over the next couple of days. It's been every show, every Weather Eyes show that we've had, we've been lucky enough to have some kind of weather event going on. And what we have happening this week is very anomalous warmth throughout the United States. So let's chat a little bit about that and the pattern that's leading to it. How do you describe exactly what's going on in the atmosphere to cause all this warmth from the plains to the East Coast?
Well, for me, I always like, whenever I look at any model images, I always like to start from the Pacific and then look east, because of course weather patterns go downstream from west to east, so the origins are often from the Pacific, so that's where I start. And it's pretty noticeable as far as a correlation for the Pacific pattern and our warmth, because we have a pretty large vortex near Alaska and very fast Pacific jet. So what that does, it brings in a lot of Pacific air flooding into the U.S. So most of the cold air gets cut off. I mean, there is some decent troughing in parts of Canada. So maybe the extreme northern tier of the central U.S. looks kind of chilly. But otherwise, it definitely is a setup for warmth. And then with that little vortex in Canada, you have some cold air there, but overall Pacific pattern. But then what I noticed interesting in the Atlantic as I move east, there's some tropical moisture in the Bahamas, and that's forming a little bit of a trough. It's a broad and large trough, but it's not a very potent trough. But what it does do is it enhances the southeast ridging behind it. So you have the Pacific, very fast Pacific jet screaming into the northwest U.S. with some troughing there. So you have some troughing there, and then you have a large southeast ridge being enhanced by tropical moisture. So when you're getting that big ridge enhancement and a large sharp gradient between that ridge and the trough to the north, and you're on that warm side of the gradient, you get a very strong highway of southwest flow right from the Gulf into the area. So it's pretty textbook.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's one of the interesting things is we've seen, and we kind of touched on this last episode, how many times this year have we seen the ridge in the southeast United States or the western Atlantic pump up at the last minute? And not even necessarily the last minute, possibly even, the medium range in terms of forecast models. And it's been amazing to see how almost all of those events have overperformed, because, you know, every time you see a mid-level ridge in the atmosphere, it seems to strengthen over the last couple of months. And this has been really from the summertime moving forward. So here we are in what most would consider mid-autumn at this point, and we have a really large ridge forming essentially from the central U.S. to the East Coast, and it's a sprawling ridge. And you, like you alluded to, you have southwest winds really bringing in some very, very warm air that will really spread from the plains all the way to the East Coast. I think the statistic today was that Islip, New York, hit a record high temperature. Was that correct?
Yeah, it is correct. I mean, one caveat about Islip's record, they don't go back that far because I think their weather station only started, I don't remember what year, but like late 70s or 80s or something. So their records only go back to then, but they still did hit a record high. I'll check their high momentarily. Cause I actually don't remember the numbers, but let's see. So Islip hit 77 in Islip. There was some southern, with some southwest flow, you still get a little bit of a quote unquote sea breeze effect on the island because you have some Atlantic component. But of course this time of year, the waters are still relatively warm. So it's not like it cooled things off dramatically, but you know, it made a difference.
Yeah, it definitely, we were alluding to that in our discussions, internally in terms of the potential for sea breezes, even though that's more of a springtime thing, this is the kind of pattern in the fall where you can get it.
Yeah. Cause like, it's not like, with the southwest flow, oftentimes, after a cool air mass comes through, you have high pressure diving down into the northeast, and then it moves away into the Atlantic, and then you get the return flow and southwest flow behind it, and you get warmth that way. And that is what happened. Of course, we had a chilly weekend with very strong radiational cooling from that high. But then once the high departed, you get the strong southwest wind. But of course, that isn't enough. Just at the surface, that's not going to be enough to really generate a heat wave. It'll generate, moderation. But the thing is, it's not just at the surface, it's a loft. And throughout pretty much most of the atmosphere, you have just a classic southwest flow. So not only are you, of course, inherently warmer at the surface, but because of the pattern aloft, your temperatures aloft are extremely warm to coincide with that surface wind shift. So I think like 850 millibar temperatures were like 14°C, which is extremely anomalous for this time of year. So
it was looking even higher than that at one point, wasn't it?
Wow. I think it might have been.
I think it was 16 Celsius at 850 millibars, which for those of you listening and maybe not as familiar, that's around 5,000 feet above your head.
NAM for tomorrow has, 15°C plus at 850.
What I was saying. It's closer to 15, 16 Celsius, which is, extremely impressive for this time of year. That's warm in summertime. So
yeah,
obviously you're not going to see heat really this time of year, but to get temperatures in the mid 80s, I guess that borders on heat. And
yeah,
this is pretty much the last time of year really where you can get this kind of pattern. We're pushing along the edge of where this type of thing is really possible before the wavelengths really start to change and the air masses really start to change. But to look at this, people will feel it, I think. For those people that might be thinking it's going to be just warm out, it's going to be really warm. It's going to be really warm. And it's not just the New York City area. It's all the way from the Ohio Valley to the Mid-Atlantic and parts of the Northeast. It's going to be extremely warm, and I think it continues into Wednesday, right? That's pretty much where the models have it right now, continuing to Wednesday.
Yeah, and then that front comes through on Thursday and brings up a pretty nice cool down, a pretty dramatic cool down, actually, for the weekend. But then, of course, we'll have to watch out for that tropical system potentially phasing with the trough and cold front that comes through. So that's going to add a lot of headaches to the forecast.
Doug, that was another fantastic segue. That's 2 weeks in a row.
Thanks. what can I say? I've been practicing, sort of.
So let's talk about that while we are on the topic. Thanks to the second amazing segue by Doug. What happens really with this pattern is we have a large ridge that builds over the central and eastern United States and the early part of this week and towards the middle part of the week, but the overall pattern in terms of the jet stream remains very progressive. And what we mean by that is the Pacific jet, and as Doug said, you always look at the Pacific first before analyzing the pattern. The Pacific jet remains very active and fast. So anything that tries to really establish itself throughout this pattern is going to have some trouble doing so. And so this ridge, while it does last a couple of days, eventually is going to begin to move to the east and collapse a little bit as the fast jet stream starts to break it down. What happens from there is pretty interesting because we have a trough coming in from the plains in the central United States, and we also have, we are uncertain to which degree it will be, but we will have the weak tropical system or some kind of tropical moisture kind of meandering in the Southwest Atlantic Ocean. And that is really the two ingredients as they come together, at least in some fashion, is going to make for a really interesting and extremely complicated forecast this week.
Yeah. This is extremely challenging, a really challenging forecast. Like, I could see anywhere between, I could see no rain and just like some clouds this weekend, or I could see like a 3 inches of washout. I really, it's yeah. really up in the air right now with all, cause I mean, yeah, the pattern in the Pacific is very progressive, which would move the flow from west to east. But thing is, when you have that tropical moisture kind of sitting and spinning, it kind of does enhance the ridging behind it. And when you're enhancing that ridging, you do get a temporary buckling to the flow where you can make things temporarily a little bit more amplified. So if that ridge is more amplified just by like wavelengths and physics, that trough in the plains gets a little bit more amplified. So considering how progressive the Pacific is, we're still able to pull off a pretty amplified trough. And that's important because if the trough is very amplified, then you get a strong pool of southerly moisture all the way from the Gulf tapping into that tropical system into the area. So we might be looking at like summertime moisture profiles ahead of this cold front on like Thursday, Friday, and maybe parts of Saturday, depending on the timing of the front and the tropical system's interaction.
Yeah, and I think that's really a good point in regards to the tropical moisture and how exactly that system in the Southwest Atlantic interacts with the incoming trough over the central United States. And how deep, one of the big things I think is how deep that trough is going to really
yeah.
have a huge impact on, you know, where these kind of almost the highway for that tropical moisture sets up. You know what I mean?
Right. Just even like, with Matthew to an extent, a lot of the forecast was predicated on how deep that incoming trough was, because the deeper that trough was, the more south to north the flow was, so moisture was allowed to stream further due north as the trough got deeper. So, I mean, of course, the setups are very different, but the theme of, well, we're looking to see how deep this trough gets is still very much in play with this forecast. And speaking of more, I guess, Matthew-type analysis, if we recall with the mild discrepancies, this was a little bit more amplified in the Pacific. It had some ridging out west, which led to a deeper trough. And that's why the GFS, at least for a few runs anyway, was showing a direct hit with Matthew. And of course, the GFS doesn't perform as well in the Pacific as the Euro does. So the GFS eventually, yeah, really at all, like so many times over and over again, get burned by the GFS's mysterious ridging in the Pacific, despite, you know, a strong Pacific jet. So this might come into play again, because once the GFS for this setup, as you move to Thursday and Friday, has a little bit of a brief PNA spike in the western half of the U.S., which helps lead to a deeper trough, which is why more tropical moisture gets propelled into the region. But the Euro, it has a decent trough, but it's still very flat in the western U.S., so the trough doesn't dig nearly as much. Like if you look at 2 p.m. on Thursday, the base of the trough on the European model is in like, you know, Missouri, northern Missouri, and like western Illinois. On the GFS model, the 18Z GFS valid for that same time frame, the trough is a lot more buckled. The base of the trough is in southeast Kansas. So it's a much more buckled flow on the GFS, more amplified, which leads to more moisture being propelled into the region. And if we apply what happened with Matthew again with regards to how the models handled the Pacific, we would probably lean more towards the Europeans' evolution of the Pacific and thus a flatter trough and thus maybe less rainfall. But, you know, of course, forecasting is not that easy, but that would be my first inclination.
Yeah, and in our premium discussion this morning, I kind of alluded to my ideas in terms of how I expect this weekend to play out because, I mean, let's face it, most of the people listening to the podcast just want to know what the heck's going to happen this weekend. And I think, you know, the overall thought that I have in my head when I look at this pattern is that we're going to head towards a more progressive solution.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's just the pattern, you know, it's one of those things where the weather pattern is kind of stuck in a progressive nature. I haven't really seen anything to change that. Even the more anomalous features have remained fairly progressive, probably since the huge heat ridge in the summertime. That was the last real feature that hung around for several days. And actually, we had that upper low around here for a while, too, a couple of weeks ago. But, you know, the overall theme with the fast Pacific jet has been progressive. And so when you look at this situation, it is a big upper level system coming into the Mississippi Valley. But the system in the Atlantic is pretty far south and east. So it would take a real significant phase, I think, to bring moisture up the East Coast. So if I were to, you know, just, I guess what I'm trying to say is if I were to be talking to a layman or just talking to someone that didn't have a much weather knowledge or not that that makes him a bad person, but if they were just asking for a basic forecast, I would tell them, you know, it's going to be unsettled this weekend, but I'm not expecting a washout.
And even, I mean, if the Europeans right and the pattern's a little more progressive, any, you know, showers would really be more of a Thursday, Friday thing. And then the tropical semi phase would be much later as far as, well, later is a poor word choice, but more so further east because if it's a more progressive pattern, inherently move east quicker. So if the European timing is correct, the phase would occur further east and north. So then the tropical enhancement wouldn't really occur until you're in New England as far as tropical moisture directly being pulled into the trough. So if that's the case, it might not rain at all during the weekend itself. So, and what's crucial about this forecast, you know, is for a lot of fall foliage lovers, you know, I'm a big fall foliage hiker. I love going to the Hudson Valley like all October weekends. I was actually just up in the Hudson Valley on Saturday doing a really nice hike. So, it would be, if the European model is right, you'd actually be fine going on a hike this weekend. So it's a big difference between the Euro and the GFS in that regard. Because if the GFS is right, you'd have some pretty heavy tropical squalls, like not widespread, but enough that would certainly make the trails too slick to hike on. So,
it's a good point. The models are very, very different. And at this rate, I mean, the progressive pattern is the way I would lean, not necessarily just because the European is showing it, but just the overall setup is how I would lean towards it. By the way, I'm just going to rapidly change subjects here. Have you looked at the radar in northern New York State?
Oh, no, I haven't looked at the radar. I've only been looking at like the GFS and the Euro.
So there is a convective complex just north of Syracuse right now.
I do see it. Yeah, wow, it's like an MCS. It's a right turning. Wow. Like that's a legit summertime right turning MCS.
There's three severe thunderstorm warnings out with that. Right
now. Sick. What, can that dive all the way here? Nah, probably not.
We can't even get a complex to get here in July, and we're trying to get it here in October. But so that just to back up, that's that front that you were talking about, or at least part of it. Some kind of complex associated with a short wave that's up there at the current time. I'm not sure what the instability parameters are up there currently, but
I haven't looked. I thought it'd be too dry. I mean, it was pretty warm today, but it wasn't like.
Viewpoints
are like 60 here, so maybe it, I mean, I haven't.
The velocity is pretty impressive too. I'll put it to you this way. I think the severe thunderstorm warnings are warranted for sure.
Yeah.
So, if you live north of Syracuse, hunker down. It looks like there's going to be some rough weather coming in over the next couple of hours as a shortwave trough produces enough lift for these storms to form, and there's plenty of atmospheric shear in place to help them remain organized. So moving forward, let's touch a little bit more on the forecast moving forward, because you know, the big theme, I think, when we look at what's going to happen over the next couple of days, you know, we have this anomalous warmth occurring. Then we get the front to come through. Then we have a potential system this weekend. And after that, I mean, by and large, when you look at the weather models, the idea of any sustained warmth kind of goes out the window after that.
Yes. Well, two things. Well, one, I do want to quickly mention, you know, more support for that severe squall. If you look at the effective shear, there's 50 knots of effective shear right on the Lake Ontario. So that's certainly helping fuel the storm. I mean, the MU Cape was like 500 to 1,000 joules per kilogram, which is decent for this time of year. But the 50 knots of effective shear, that means you're getting rotation right where the updrafts are trying to form. So it's really maximizing the efficiency of the rotation within the atmosphere. So certainly pretty impressive. But going back to your point about, yeah, the sustained warmth going pretty much out the window after this warm-up. I remember not too long ago you mentioned how the flow is pretty progressive and there's really nothing that no signs of that really breaking, because it hasn't broken pretty much for the last few months. But this might be the first time we could see an actual break in the progressive regime, assuming the tropical moisture does eventually phase with that trough, because a lot of times when you get phasing in the Northwest Atlantic with dramatic mid-latitude cyclones, you pump up a lot of latent heat into the NAO region, and that can help flip the NAO strongly negative. So that, and some of the models are introducing a pretty strong west-based negative NAO block, which leads to a piece of the polar vortex sitting just to the south of that in southeast Canada, which leads to, of course, pretty chilly temperatures over our area, and which would be a pretty big change over what we've seen.
And we noticed, I mean, a couple of us were talking today earlier, and I feel like you would be pretty good at articulating this. We have, for the second year in a row, different times of year, obviously, but for the second year in a row, it appears we will have a very anomalous ridge in the Kara Sea. And I wanted you to kind of, if you could, articulate why that is important, why something that far away can be important for the weather here. I think it's, obviously understanding it, it's a very fascinating and important part of our weather. But how would you break that down so people can understand exactly what the importance is?
Well, it's really like a domino effect. I mean, it's not like instantly, oh, there's a big ridge in the Kara Sea. That means snow. I mean, it's not that instant. But I mean, whenever we are shifting, or at least looking for a pattern shift or a more anomalous weather pattern that would bring more storminess or cold weather to the eastern half of the U.S., you look for high latitude blocking. And right now, if you look at, you know, the most models throughout the northern hemisphere, you just see a lot of negative height anomalies throughout all the Arctic. So, which is the opposite of blocking. Blocking is noted by a lot of ridging in those areas, which forces the cold air southward and weakens the polar vortex. But as we move towards 84, 96, 108 hours, so day 3, 4, and 5, a very large ridge develops in the Kara Sea, which, of course, seems inconsequential, but if it builds strong enough, if it builds strongly enough, what it does do is it presses into northern Greenland and it can press into parts of the Arctic domain. So that means you're already weakening the polar vortex just a bit, because you're interfering with their current Arctic regime. And then when that's combined with a phasing storm pumping up the heights in southern and western Greenland, they can bridge together. they bridge together, you get just a large feature of general ridging in the NAO region. And then down the road, that buckles the whole pattern in the U.S. and in the Arctic, which can, in general, lead to more ridging. And then it's usually like a 5 to 8 day process. But once that occurs, you can really start seeing dramatic shifts in the general regime of our weather.
It's a great way to put it. I think domino effect was the perfect word. You said that early in that little monologue.
I love that phrasing.
You know, it really is because, you know, there's a lot of technical jargon that can get thrown around, like wave one, wave two, things like that. But, you know, when you look at the Kara Sea, it's not a coincidence that these large scale ridging events there cause significant changes around the globe. Now, I mean, the Kara Sea is far away, man. You know, for some people, they were to look at that and say that would affect our weather, it would be insane. But, you know, it really is such a huge thing when you have something so anomalous occurring there. And last winter, for those that might not remember, we had a very anomalous ridge in the Kara Sea. Was it January 1st? I think it was. Right around that time, right?
Yeah, right around that time, early January.
Yep, and that kind of kicked off a changing pattern that I'll stop short of saying it led directly to the big storm we had at the end of January, but the whole hemispheric pattern changed. I mean, it kicked off a domino effect of major changes in the atmosphere in terms of ridges and troughs, where we had a very poor pattern for snowfall, and the big ridge in the Kara Sea totally disrupted the hemispheric wave pattern. And what occurred after that, while maybe not a gigantic ridge from the Davis Strait to Greenland in central Canada, was a pretty impressive blocking event that followed after that.
Right. I mean, because all you need is just some sort of ridging being able to poke into the Arctic. And when you have a very massive and building Kara Sea ridge, you're going to send wave interference. You're going to send perturbations into the Arctic that eventually at some point there has to be a threshold that snaps where the pattern finally does change somewhat. So that's pretty much what, you know, it has to start somewhere. And usually it starts with one anomalous feature and then a domino effect after it, to where you send, I don't want to get too technical, but you send just different fluxes of ridging into the Arctic. And then, yeah, it's just a domino effect after that.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, without getting too technical also, those fluxes of change can go all throughout into the stratosphere. And when you have a change on that level, that eventually trickles back down and affects everything down to the atmosphere at the local level as well. So it's all connected in some way. And something like a huge ridge in the Kara Sea is something that will really disrupt the pattern throughout the hemisphere that has been established for quite some time. And the wave one, wave two stuff is something for another podcast when we get a little more deeper into the winter forecast. But I think that it's a good place to start in kind of discussing how we expect the pattern to change here next couple of weeks. High latitude blocking is something that we haven't seen a lot of recently at all.
Yeah, I don't really remember the last like true high latitude blocking episode. I mean, yeah, I don't really. I mean, you can count a large negative EPO ridge as high latitude blocking because the EPO region does technically extend into the high latitudes, and there were some blocking ridges there. So I guess maybe, you know, as recently as the 2014-2015 winter, you could say, oh, high latitude blocking from that massive EPO ridge into Alaska we had. But I don't know if that's what people think of when they, you know, hear high latitude blocking. So, yeah. Besides that, I don't really recall the last true high latitude blocking episode besides Sandy. Well, the days preceding Sandy.
Yeah, I mean, a high latitude blocking episode, it kind of depends on exactly how you define it, because we've had huge negative Arctic oscillations. There hasn't really been a really well established negative North Atlantic oscillation in quite some time. Everything's been pretty progressive. In terms of, you know, there have been big blocks and there have been events where we've had high latitude blocks and, you know, things like that. But there hasn't been really a well-established one. You think, like you said, you think back to Sandy, and then a couple of years before that, 2010, 2009, those were ridiculous.
Yes. I mean, well, then we were getting a lot of NAO blocks. Like, we thought we were getting we thought we were going to have a nice little episode of negative NAOs for a while, and then that flipped. But
Yeah.
So
we'll get into this a little bit more. We're going to take a break for, I think it's, I'm going to set it for like 3 minutes or so. And when we come back, we're going to talk about our winter forecast and a little bit about where we are in terms of what we're looking for with the winter forecast moving forward. So we'll be back in about 3 minutes. Hang tight, and we'll talk to you guys momentarily. All right, right on schedule. We are back. Doug, are you still with us, or did I lose you?
You're with me, but unfortunately, the Sharks tied the Rangers, so I'm not too happy. But
see what happens when we take a break.
Yeah, they were up 1-0. The Rangers were, and then Sharks went on a 5-on-3, and they scored. So, and now we're at the intermission.
How did they get up to a 5-on-3? What happened?
I wasn't like, you know, I honestly didn't see the actual penalty. I just noticed, 5-on-4 power play, and the Rangers had a shorthanded opportunity and almost scored. The next thing I knew, it was 5-on-3. I didn't actually see it, but yeah.
Well, I'm seeing some discontent on social media in regards to a penalty that should have been called against San Jose. But
of course.
No use in arguing over it now because the Rangers are tied. But did they play well in that in the period?
I thought they looked pretty good. Yeah.
All right, that's good enough. They looked good the first couple of games. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially last year was really painful to watch. They couldn't control.
Well,
there was very few games that I watched the Rangers control last year.
Yeah, they had no puck possession for like all last season. Even like last season, I remember they got off to a ridiculously hot start in the standings, but it was so unsustainable because they weren't possessing the puck. It was just Lundqvist bailing them out.
And then it finally
caught up to them.
I think the hope this year is that, you know, they have better possession, they're better talent, and Lundqvist still does the same thing, and they end up in a good spot, so I'm pretty excited about
they're
it.
They're a lot younger this year. I like that they're a lot younger this year, which I think will help them actually use Elaine Vigneault's system of spacing and speed better. So I'm optimistic, but you know, we'll see.
It's early. We got plenty of time to talk about it throughout the winter.
Yeah, we'll do a separate sports podcast.
I wonder how that would do. That might
be
well. Yeah, I did a spot with a good friend of mine. I did a spot on ESPN Radio a couple weeks ago with a good friend of mine. Ricky Sobrano. He does ESPN New York Peace of Mind, and it's a show up in New England, and they talk about New York. So I was on there for a while. So if we want to talk sports, we can do that. I'd gladly do that. So
nice. That's a great title. So New York Peace of Mind. Yeah. But anyway,
I know.
We have a Kerosene Ridge developing.
I don't know if that was his. I'm gonna have to ask him. It might be. It's definitely better than Weather Eyes for sure. It's a really good title.
Yeah.
I don't.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was. If he came up with it, or if ESPN, I'll have to double check who created it. But
right.
Yeah, it's a great show. They chat about New York sports and, you know, give it a little New York flavor to New England. So it's pretty cool. So
nice.
If you guys are interested in a weekend show, it's Saturday. I think it usually airs around 2:00. So check it out. Okay, let's get back to weather. Let's talk about our winter forecast. I guess let's just lay it out since we have about 20 minutes left to talk about it. Let's chat about where we are in terms of, you know, it's only been, we announced it, I guess it was last week, we announced the winter forecast dates and how everything is going to go in terms of the release of the winter forecast. But let's talk a little bit about what goes into it. What do you think are the most important things to monitor here over the next couple of weeks?
I think the progression of the stratospheric polar vortex is going to be the most important. Especially if you want to see an early start to the winter. I'm still not convinced the ENSO signal is strong enough to really be the predominant driver towards our weather. Mm-hmm. So I think towards the polls and seeing how, maybe if this Karasi Ridge is going to help perturb the polar vortex and weaken it to help for an early start to winter. At least that's what I'm going to be looking at for the next couple of weeks. I don't know if that's going to be the most important thing for the whole winter, but, usually I like to go month by month by month as far as forecasting winter. So, at least for the early part of the winter, I think it's important to see what's happening with the stratospheric polar vortex.
Yeah, I think it's so critical. And it's you can look at as many statistics as you want right now and look at as much as you want about the stratospheric polar vortex and where it is compared to 2014, 2001, yada, yada, year, whatever. But crunch time, really, when you start to look at this stuff, is late October and November. It's really...
Yeah.
Because you and I have both seen it. We've seen the stratospheric vortex just, in terms of the temperature, just jump because you get a warming event. It's something kicked off like we have with the Karasi Ridge right now. There's a lot of people getting caught up in terms of where the stratospheric vortex is right now in terms of temperature compared to this year or that year. But I think it's much more important to look at what's going to happen over the next couple of weeks. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right now, the verbatim position right now, I don't think it's that important, but it'll be interesting to see where it is, especially after this Karasi blocking event occurs, because, I'm going to repeat the phrase domino effect again, because of course, if this Karasi blocking can weaken the stratospheric polar vortex, then that in turn would weaken or perturb the regular or the tropospheric polar vortex and increase the odds of it meandering in November and December and parts of January too, before climatology would say that it would eventually have to re-strengthen again. But of course, that's getting pretty far out.
Yeah, I think it's definitely, the stratospheric vortex has gotten a little bit of a bad rap here over the last couple of years because people have begun to lose hope in terms of forecasting it. But I think a lot of that has to do with unrealistic expectations. There's a lot of people that don't, and some of this might be on the meteorologists, maybe we don't explain it exactly the way that we should. There seems to be a little bit of unrealistic expectations in terms of what a stratospheric warming event can do.
Right, or forecasting one to occur based on correlations that don't necessarily have causation. Like we have all these granted, these scientists are brilliant, but there's all these indices that have been invented, like the SAI, the Snow Advance Index, and October Polar Index, all these like numerical indices that apparently correlate to a weaker stratospheric polar vortex, and thus you would think would lead to a sudden stratospheric warming event and more high latitude blocking. But these indices rely on like snow cover advancing at a certain rate and snowing on certain days, and I think it's really hard to for a numerical index that relies on so many nuances of snow to really directly correlate to the weather. But the thing is, because these research papers showed such a high correlation number between this SAI index and a weak stratospheric polar vortex, we all became excited about, one, the idea of getting improved long-range forecasting, and two, the fact that the SAI was really high the last few winters, which would have led to more blocking, but that didn't really pan out. So we need to really look towards, instead of using these numbers and these potentially voodoo correlations, we need to, use the tools that we've learned for all these years as meteorologists and look at the pattern developing and how we know the pattern developing would really deteriorate or strengthen the polar vortex. And I think if we focus more on the actual physical drivers we know about rather than the statistical numbers that may or may not affect anything, we'll lead ourselves in the right direction.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think our winter forecast last year, and this is not to, this is going to come off a little bit like a brag, but it's not meant to be that way. What I'm trying to say is I think our winter forecast last year was so successful because we didn't get caught up in all of the all of that stuff. You know, we generally followed the pattern and how we expected it to play out. Here's an interesting question, though, and this is I wanted to bounce this off of you, and I'll tell you my opinion. But last year, last fall, we saw the stratospheric vortex weaken a little bit and then tighten up in the beginning of December. And that really was a problem that lingered throughout the rest of the winter after it tightened up in December. So what are your thoughts on the potential for this Carassee ridge occurring now, some high latitude blocking, and then a return to the pattern with the stratospheric vortex tightening up again to start winter?
I think it's certainly possible that it could strengthen up again, especially if the Carassee ridge deteriorates the vortex very quickly, because then it would theoretically have more time to strengthen again. But I do think last year is very different, because I think the strong El Nino was one of the main reasons why the vortex was able to strengthen again. Because with the strong El Nino, you have a very strong, well, you tend to anyway, have a very strong Pacific jet and a lot of just, warmer air being plowed into Canada, which generally leads to colder air north of it. And, generally when you have, colder air in the Alaska and, just general in the Arctic regions, you're not really going to be perturbing the polar vortex. So I think the El Nino pattern was one reason why it kind of readily strengthened, especially considering in December, the El Nino effects are the strongest. So since El Nino tends to correlate, to an unfavorable Arctic pattern for a weakening polar vortex, and the fact that December, the El Nino has the strongest effects, I think that's, I don't think it's fair to compare, what happened to last year. Doesn't mean the vortex can't strengthen again, but I do think the main trigger was the way the El Nino was behaving. And this year we don't have an El Nino, so maybe a weakening of the polar vortex could actually last a little bit longer if it were to occur, of course.
I think one of the big things that's being lost in the winter forecast idea is that, a lot of people are focusing too much on whether or not we have a La Nina. I think what's more important is that we don't have a huge El Nino like we did last year. It's such a significant difference in terms of how the atmosphere behaves, how the hemisphere behaves, when you don't have such an anomalous event ongoing like we did last year with the El Nino. So we were fighting that in a lot of aspects throughout the cold season. And fighting doesn't necessarily mean just in terms of snow. Just the whole hemisphere was being adjusted by what was going on in the tropical Pacific. This year, whether it's La Nina or not, by technical terms, the way that the whole hemisphere is going to be behaving is very different. And I think that's one of the main points is, people in general, when they're doing seasonal forecasting, they're looking for what are the drivers, what are the big things that are going to help us here to figure out this forecast. And that's one of the big things for me when I look at this is we don't have a super El Nino anymore. Instead, what we have is a pattern that is much more moderated in terms of the anomalies that were occurring last year. And I think it takes a little bit of perspective, and you have to kind of step back a little bit and take a look at exactly what that means again. Because last year, we really were in an extremely anomalous situation.
Right. And that extremely anomalous situation makes the weather a little bit more predictable, because when you know for a fact, your main driver is going to be this, then we can use our tools to say, okay, this main driver leads to X, Y, and Z. So while, of course, that doesn't mean you're going to get all the specifics right, but it means you're going to get the general themes right. But without that strong ENSO signal, all the other drivers that would be used for winter forecast are much less inherently predictable. So, I'm not ready to say, if the Carassee Ridge weakens the vortex in late October, early November, that means it has to strengthen by November, December. you know, there it's the way the pattern in the northern latitudes work, it's too unpredictable to really make a definitive claim. Oh yeah, that means it has, it's going to strengthen again. Oh no, it's going to stay weak. We don't really know yet, but I do think for wanting an early season snow event, it's a good start to have this Carrasee Ridge happening now. That's as far as I'll go, but yeah.
Right. Yeah, I think I agree with that. And it certainly helps too, because when you, when we were talking last week about the way we expected the pattern to shake down, one of the things that we kept bringing up was that we expected early high latitude blocking in December. And to see some things like this beginning to shake out in the atmosphere is very encouraging.
Yeah, I'm definitely, well, definitely happy to see that. And of course, that also, you know, the tanking Arctic oscillation from the Carrasee Ridge is certainly a good sign. And yeah, you'd think, you know, at the very least, that's going to put a significant dent in the polar vortex. So, actually, you know, like going back to the meteor ranges for a quick sec, you see like the Euro at day like 8, 9, and 10, like the Carrasee Ridge went on, went so strong that it completely ridge bridged with the that phasing disturbance that for this weekend, and created a giant NAO block and a large polar vortex just to the south of it. And like it has like a pretty intriguing storm setup in the Ohio Valley and Northeast. So it just goes to show you what just what can happen when you have pattern developing. You get these storms, these large storms cutting to your south. You know, if this European setup were to happen 6 weeks from now, it'd be pretty fun.
are we gonna talk about the day 10 Euro right now? We're gonna dive
in. Yeah. I love it. Fun.
So but let's talk about the thing though, with what you touched on. The system for this weekend is a really important part of the pattern moving forward. So for those of you who are trying to gain a little perspective here, the ridge in the Carrasee, which by the way is on the other side of the globe, develops really by this weekend. That it becomes a very, very anomalous feature by this weekend. And, you know, by and large, it will begin to have its effects over time. So the wave breaking pattern will begin to occur. The Carrasee Ridge will have its effects on the hemisphere. But what Doug alluded to is that the system this weekend that we're talking about in terms of smaller scale things like showers and rain and tropical moisture, by the middle part of next week, that system actually heads up into the northern Atlantic Ocean. And it works to enhance a ridge ahead of it, which on some ensemble guidance actually strengthens and works together with that ridge in the Carrasee, so that now you have positive height anomalies extending from the Davis Strait to Greenland and all the way to the Carrasee, which is a tremendous amount of area. And what does, and if you want to think in your head in terms of really what a block does, is you have this anomalous ridging over those areas of the Arctic, and all of the air that's there is displaced. So you have colder air being displaced all different directions, and one of those directions that it typically gets displaced is just to the north of us over southeast Canada. And that's what we're beginning to see on forecast models. And while the individual solutions may vary, Doug was alluding to the fact that this high latitude blocking is starting to appear now on medium range guidance.
Right. And if that were to occur, you know, it could potentially send a pretty large storm system to our south. And then, you know, I could see a pretty big storm occurring at the end of the month during this Carrasee Ridge shuffling. I don't know the exact time frame, the exact day this would occur, of course, but yeah, I really wouldn't be surprised if this was like the first snow threat for the ski resorts. Getting pretty speculative there, but when you see the tools with the Carrasee Ridge and that anomalous feature and how normally things progress from there, with the Arctic oscillation tanking from that, you usually can get a decent idea. Okay. Storminess with, about maybe a week or two afterwards. So that's definitely a time frame we're watching for some sort of storminess along the Eastern U.S. And of course, I'm going to be a weenie for a sec. If this setup were to have happened like, you know, 6 weeks from now, it'd be a pretty big snowstorm setup. But, you know, for unfortunately for snow lovers, it is still October, so yeah, can't get too excited yet. But on the winter forecast note, of course, since we were talking about the winter forecast initially, if the European model were to be correct with completely ridge connecting the ridge ahead of the tropical moisture and the Carassi Ridge, if they link up, you get this massive ridge, then you're really going to be putting a large dent into the stratospheric polar vortex and the tropospheric polar vortex, which of course could have huge implications to how the pattern in November and December develops. So not only would it directly affect our sensible weather for late October or early November, but it could help shape the beginning of the winter as well.
Yeah, I think that's a big thing. That's a key point. When you look at the pattern and how it's evolving here over the next couple of days and weeks, it's not just a small scale change or a temporary change. It's a really significant change that's occurring. And obviously, you know, another thing that's important to touch on is the details are still going to be figured out, and they will have a huge impact on exactly what it means. But this huge ridge in the Carassi is the first step in a pattern that is starting to change towards the end of October. And as we head towards the end of October, it looks very likely that we're going to start to see a more active pattern, essentially from, I would say, I think the plains is a good place to start, right? The plains eastward.
Yeah, I would say so, yeah.
With temperatures near or below normal, and the propensity for shots of colder air, because we are looking at a pattern that really tends to be favorable for high latitude blocking to develop. And when you look at the ensembles, I mean, the European and the GFS ensembles both have a huge area of above normal temperatures in the mid levels from the Carassi all the way to Greenland. And this is valid right around, what is that, the 25th of October, then moving forward through the 30th, it pretty much stays. So it's a very early process of sniffing out this high latitude blocking, but seeing that Carassi ridge there on the forecast models, it tells you that we're probably entering a pattern that's going to begin to undergo some changes. And the interesting question is going to be really, like you said, how long does this last? How long does this linger? And really, does it affect the stratospheric vortex? And where does that leave us in the troposphere moving forward as we head towards winter? That's the huge question that
we don't really know the answer to yet, unfortunately.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's so important for the winter forecast too, you know?
Yeah.
It's
fun to have something to watch, you know, because, you know, over the past few weeks, you know, you generally make your own analogs about correlations to, you know, past years. But the winter forecast finally gets fun when you can actually start tracking our current weather and how it affects the winter, because then you're using tools that are, in my opinion, more fun to look at. I like looking at, you know, the 500 millibar anomalies and how they are progressing in the northern hemisphere, in the whole northern hemisphere. So it gets fun when you start actually connecting your current weather and the medium range weather to the winter forecast rather than just using only long range tools.
I agree. And I think it's coming down to crunch time. So the next few episodes of Weather Eyes are going to be more and more interesting as we go along, no?
Yes, sir.
we're gonna get into some more details and more of the nitty gritty. So we're coming up on time here. We're gonna wrap it up now a little minute or two early. But Doug, do you have anything else you wanted to throw in here before we wrap up, or are you pretty much all weathered out?
Yeah, I'm pretty weathered out. I mean, definitely gonna be warm tomorrow and Wednesday. I almost forgot about that. About the record warmth we're getting, but yeah.
Are you gonna watch the rest of the Ranger game now?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, there's also I think I'm gonna watch some baseball too. And I know there's Jets and Arizona Cardinals too, but I'm not a huge football fan. I'm a Giants fan, but besides the Giants and fantasy football, I'm not like a huge into football. So
how dare you?
Rangers and baseball for me.
Yeah, me too. Me too. I'm just kidding. I'm right there with you.
Yeah.
I mean, we have some forecasting to do tonight, of course, but we always keep the sports games on too. But it's a pretty big night. I mean, we have the baseball, the Rangers, the football. So it'll be fun to keep it on.
Rick Nash has scored.
Wow, that's new.
Yeah, I haven't heard that. Rick Nash scored. Those three words uttered in the same sentence in months, not years.
Good for him. All right, so let's wrap it up. This has been a great episode. I think it's been our best episode yet.
Yeah, I think
so. It's been a pleasure, and we will we'll check back in next week with more information on where we are with our winter forecast. For those of you who are listening, you're always welcome to head over to our website and check out our latest thoughts on the blog. If you're looking for more detailed forecasts for yourself or for your business, check out the premium content and shoot us a message on the contact form, and we'll get right back to it.
And of course, these podcasts are archived. So if you missed a good chunk of the show, you can always feel free to listen to it later.
Right.
We'll provide the links. I mean, we have a webpage for them now, right?
Yeah, we do. Yeah, I got to tweet that out. That was another good segue.
Right.
That's three. Doug, thank you as always. And for all of you for listening, thanks for checking in with us on Monday nights. We love doing this, and we're really excited to keep doing it throughout the winter. So everyone have a good night. Enjoy, and we will talk to you guys next week. Take care.